Welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Benson. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Today we've got Mackenzie Jackson from Git Guardian with us. Hello, Mackenzie. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. So, Mackenzie, go on. No, say what you're going to say. Go.
I was just saying that I briefly forgot that this is an audio-only podcast, and I was waving at the camera like a lunatic. but I'm realizing now that it's audio-only, so I'll stop making obscene gestures.
No. It's good. I can wave back, and then, you know, you'll laugh. The audience won't know why. Anyway, so, Mackenzie, come on. We always get this. Who are you? Tell us why you're on this podcast. How do you find Python? How did we meet? What's your backstory?
Yeah, I got an interesting backstory. I was actually started off life in my first life as an architect, like a building architect, and I hated it. And I spent most of my job trying to automate it by learning to code in some of these big systems that we have called, you know, BIM systems. And then I was kind of figuring out, like, why don't I just skip this architecture thing and do what I want to do, which is write software. So then I kind of went down that path and had my own startup for a while called Compago, which it's still around today. It's headquartered in Australia. I haven't been involved in it. I was in there for about 4 years as the CTO. And then I left, I guess, when the company got big enough that it needed a real CTO. But the one thing that I loved about coding, a bit of a subsection, is that we were a care provider building technology in kind of healthcare space, which means we had to comply with a lot of different areas like HIPAA compliance and other things. And going down that, I really learned how vulnerable software was to lots of different things and how to secure it. And I got really into that. So when I left, I decided to kind of focus on security. And that's been pretty much my jam. I work now for a company called Git Guardian, which is a code security platform. And one of the coolest things about my job is I get to work with some research teams. We discover, you know, how attackers are kind of exploiting code. We create talks about that. And then we get to go to some cool conferences, which is where I meet cool people like Carlton, because we met at PyCon in Italy. Which was, I think probably one
over
of the best
pizza,
conferences.
I believe.
I think we'll at some after party, and you were the keynote. And so I was trying to hassle you to use your keynote powers to get more drinks than the one drink limit that was allowed at the party. If I remember correctly.
Okay. So, something like that. Anyway, that's not suitable for the show. So let's move on. So attackers are sporting. So I've, you know, as part of my fellow role, I joined the Django security team, and we get quite a lot of reports for, you know, every month we'll have reports go on. So you do a lot of that forensic work trying to find exploits, or you have done, or you work with teams that are doing.
Yeah, we kind of work with teams that within Git Guardian and also external that really look at some large-scale research projects into how attackers are operating. Particularly around exploiting secrets, exploiting credentials, also exploiting like misconfigurations. And one of the cool things that we really like to get into is when an attack happens, to try and recreate that attack path to try and figure out exactly, you know, not only like how did they get in, but what tools did they use? Can we recreate the system and point out exactly what we meant vulnerable? Because the nature of security vulnerability reporting is that if an application has a security flaw that gets exploited, then the blog post that inevitably comes out from the company is extremely limited and won't give too much information. So it's kind of taking that and then trying to figure out what's behind it really.
Well, I mean, so even with the issues that are on Django, we just kind of like, we'll put a post, we'll say, look, there's a DOS vulnerability or it's vulnerable to maliciously crafted input, but we won't necessarily say exactly how you do the attack. For one reason, we don't sort of want to make it too easy for the people who are attacking unpatched Djangos. So I guess it's difficult to know how much you should say, because I kind of also, in the same breath, I kind of think an attack is not going to be put off by the lack of detail in the report. They're just going to work it out. I don't know.
Yeah, I think exactly. So there's varying levels of thought behind this, and you have to be responsible in how you disclose, you know, information. And we certainly wouldn't just put out kind of like a cheat sheet of, you know, how to do it, but at least finding out, you know, at what point where was initial access made. Where did they actually go? Was it a phishing campaign? How did the whole thing start and unravel? Now, when you're talking about CVEs or like vulnerabilities and dependencies and things like that, then, well, it's a lot, you have to be a lot more responsible in how you disclose that, because as you would know, 2 years on, there's still people running vulnerable packages, right, and things. So you have to be a bit more careful. But in terms of recreating it, and not necessarily just showing the logic behind which the attack is used, because I think a lot of people don't understand attackers' logic, if that makes sense.
Well, one example you might be able to give is we had various issues fixed over time about enumeration attacks, where, you know, where people are able to, they make a request and it's perfectly legitimate request, but it somehow reveals something about the application or the IDs or something like that, and then they make the next one and they make the next one, and by doing that kind of thing, they're able to kind of get a size of the application or predict IDs or predict URLs. And in and of itself, that's not really a vulnerability, but perhaps then they use that as part of a bigger attack, and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Like exploiting logic flaws and how to do things. And you know, like a lot of kind of attacks happen because people use, you know, the wrong function. So the wrong, you know, you're generating a random number. There's multiple ways to generate a random number. Some are predictable using maths, but so if you're trying to use something to create access via these random numbers, then you have to be sure to use the right thing. Now, that doesn't mean that the insecure version is pointless. It has its reason. It's just kind of the logic behind which you're implementing it is kind of flawed, and people can often like figure that out.
I'd add one more question that came up from what you said, and then I'll, you know, see if Will's got a question or something. But I kind of always say that you must update. You must be on a secure version. You mustn't use an end-of-life version of Django. And I say that simply because I think as soon as these reports are out in the open, within a short period of time, there's a just bots or kits you can download, which you can automatically run, which test every available export known. And it's not a question of if your system is cracked, it's just when it's cracked. Is that fair? Is that a reasonable approach, or am I being a bit over cautious there, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, like no, I don't think you're being overly cautious. I think that's you absolutely have to patch regularly, and definitely patch anything that has vulnerabilities against it. Like, it's right, absolutely vital to be able to do that. And what we typically find in companies that can't patch regularly is that you should always have a system in place to patch regularly, regardless whether or not there's some critical CVE, because if you're in a habit of doing it regularly, it becomes easier when you need to do it and it's critical to do it.
Right.
And I think a lot of people kind of will patch when something's critical, but, you know, that can cause all kinds of havoc, and it becomes a scary thing to do. And I think people often shy away from it, but, you know, patching regularly is absolutely fundamental, especially when there's a vulnerability out against it. The argument kind of against patching regularly, and it's a bit of a weak argument, but just to make it, is that it takes about, when a new version comes out, often it can take about 3 months to figure out if it's vulnerable to anything, especially if it's like a big change in, right, in something. Yeah. So then, you know, the argument is, do you patch immediately when a new version is out, or do you kind of wait? And I think the solution is, you know, like patch regularly whenever there's a vulnerability known against it, and then stick to a regular patching routine for everything else where it's consistent, and you're doing it. But if there is a vulnerability, people will be able to find it. They build scripts to be able to like exploit these automatically. You know, we're not talking about the most sophisticated actors. If there's a CVE against it, like you've basically given the cheat codes to how to exploit your application, so you should definitely patch.
Yeah, right. Okay. And I guess just that point about new versions, I guess for Django, say, you know, 5.0 is about to come out, And you might wait for 5.0.1 or 5.0.2 if you're particularly worried, you know, about those first regressions. But meanwhile, 4.2 point whatever is still being released with the security updates. So you should definitely be getting that each month.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you're lucky enough, to, I mean, hopefully people like here are using Django, you know, using well-supported frameworks like that.
They should be on this show, I tell you.
On our podcast, yeah.
Because, I mean, well, there's a lot of frameworks that aren't, you know, that don't go through that security, that don't have the security team going through it. So, yeah, you're already on the good step if you're using Django.
Oh, well, thank you. We'll put that on we'll pull out quote on the website.
Well, since you mentioned that, I'll throw this question to you because Carlton and I were not sure how to address it. So Flask, which is another big Python web framework, recently there was some discussion in the community about something unrelated to security, but that's an example of something widely used that, as far as I'm aware, does not have like a formal security team, for example. And so I'm curious if you saw any of that. There was an issue with like Flask login, which is essentially a third party package where it hasn't been maintained. And so there's a new version of Flask and all of a sudden login was breaking for everyone. And there were some comments about that and people thinking that Flask was this, you know, Microsoft or something and had all the support when really it's like one person and a handful of volunteers maintaining. So I guess more like I just wanted to address that because it's been out there, but I'm curious, like where you sit, when you see web frameworks, you see that, right? There's the whole gamut. There's Django, and then there's many widely used frameworks that are, you know, may not have robust security things. I'm not saying putting that on Flask, but like a lot of these projects may have lots of users and it's a, you know, handful of people doing it.
I mean, absolutely. And it's always this like way up between using like what may be cutting edge. Like at one point, Django was like cutting edge right out there. You were a trendsetter if you were using it, you know. And so a lot of security often doesn't come into the equation until later on too. You know, when we first built the Compago, the startup that I was in, we had a .NET backend and a React frontend. Why? Because that was like we had a .NET guy and we had a React guy.
Right, exactly.
So like, you know, that's what we, you know, like that's what we had, right? So we're just, you know, everyone's like, why aren't you using Node and React? Because we didn't have a Node guy. We had a .NET guy. So, you know, and so when it comes to like these types of frameworks and things like that, you know, like if you have the foresight, and I think, you know, people that have been around for a while will be able to know and they understand it. And, you know, certain different frameworks would do different things. They may be more secure. They may be faster. They may be able to handle large quantities of data better. So there's like lots of considerations and often security is a forethought, but you really, there's a couple of things to look for when choosing a framework. One, does it have a long history of being maintained? And I don't necessarily mean like years and years and years. I mean, you know, is it constantly being maintained? Is there a community around it?
Yeah.
Because if those are the cases, then you should, you know, you can start to check off and feel a bit better. Is there a security team for it? Well, that's not normal, you know, for everything, but that should definitely help you kind of make those decisions. So if you are in the fortunate position to be able to pick frameworks, then looking at the community, looking at the team that maintains it, because you will be surprised. You know, what happens is the example of the of UA parser. I apologize for everyone. This is a Node, you know, package.
But that's okay.
There'll be a Python equivalent, but you know, UA parser was just a package that let you know what operating system your users were, you know, viewing your app on. It's something very simple. It was used by, it had 10 million weekly downloads, and it was maintained by one guy named Fischel. And his NPM account got hacked, and then someone created a malicious version for it. You know, this is because, you know, this is one guy maintaining this, thanklessly. You know, and it would have passed everything, but you have to also consider the team behind these, not just is it popular.
Yeah, and think go on. So thinking about that, I mean, PyPI have done an awful lot recently about tightening up, just within the Python ecosystem, about tightening up. You know, you need to use two-factor auth now if you're a popular project, and they've got this trusted publishers thing. What's that?
So in terms of, so Py is actually was an NPM and also Git like GitHub is also forcing two-factor authentication, because this was pretty much one of the main ways attackers were kind of creating malicious applications, is that what would typically happen is that people would specialize in kind of phishing these maintainers, getting into their accounts. And if there's no two-factor authentication, you know, like a well-structured phishing campaign isn't easy, but it's certainly a lot easier if there's no 2FA to get into it. And these supply chain type of attacks can have massive implementations, you know, because you're not just attacking this one system. You know, you're potentially creating a vulnerability on millions of applications. So one thing to remember about attackers is that they operate on economics like a normal business does, where there's a risk reward. Like, is the risk of me attacking this system going to outweigh the reward that I, you know, that I could get potentially? And when you're talking about systems, you know, like PyPI packages that are being used by millions of different applications, then, you know, the reward is massive potentially, because you could install, you know, even a crypto miner that gets released onto a million websites, you know, can create something so simple, can create, you know, pretty good profits. So it's really good that these package managers are actually implementing, you know, more security implementations around this, because it like 2FA may not seem like a lot, but you will really strip back the amount of account takeovers from that.
It's just significantly harder because of that extra step, because they've got somehow trick you into entering that as well at the same time.
Yeah, and exactly, and then like the step above that is the trusted publishers, I think, by PyPI, which, you know, like which is another set of requirements that PyPI, you know, puts on these publishers to make sure that that doesn't happen. So, you know, making sure that there's not long-lived passwords that's being accessed in there, so that when you look at that, it's just another tick box. And when you're choosing packages, you know, just, you don't need to spend hours on it. It should be easy to look at something and say, oh, this is secure. And that's why something like the trusted publishers is really powerful, because, you know, you can quickly look at that and know that it meets the criteria of at least that minimum. So you can move forward. It's actually quite powerful in terms of being able to quickly make decisions of what to introduce into your project.
Okay.
And is it going to be secure?
Okay. I'm getting a little niggle inside, though, because there's some of these metrics that you sometimes get on projects. They can be like, did you tick this box? Did you tick that box? And it's like, some of them are you using a particular feature on GitHub? And it's a bit like, well, no, we're not using that. Particularly, say, for instance, Django. Django's got its own release program. Release process, it's got its own security process, it's got security archive, it does its way of handling CVEs. It's all, you know, top quality, really. But it's not going through the GitHub security advisories panel. Therefore, we don't get the tick in the box on that metric. And, you know, sorry, I sometimes get a little bit like, oh, I hate these metrics. But
I can totally understand that. But when you're the rebut that I would have to that is that I find that these metrics are more for smaller packages.
Yeah, right.
You know, being able to use them with confidence, rather than, you know, something that's massive, you know, that's trusted by people. If it doesn't have the tick box, then you can still get it passed. But in terms of, like, if I'm just looking for, I just need a package that's going to be able to do the small job, you know, can I trust putting this into my production or not? If it has the tick box, then that's a good step. You know, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And no security will be the be-all and end-all. And like, I work for a vendor, and, you know, we have people that come up to us and just be like, okay, so here's my list of requirements that I need to tick for my SOC certification or for this or for that. You know, like, where does your product fit in? Oh, you don't fit into this tick box? Oh, I don't need it then. It's kind of like, so they're not worried at all about getting hacked. They're worried about, like, compliance, and I guess that's important, but... So I understand.
Yes, where
you're coming from.
How good is the box on the questionnaire? Is it, you know, because if the box on the questionnaire isn't right, it's no good at all. Okay.
Yeah, and how do you make a questionnaire that fits everyone, right? It's the same questionnaire box for such wildly different applications.
Well, the two-factor authentication is interesting because this is a thing in Django with there is no built-in two-factor auth. There is a third-party package that JazzBand maintains, but maybe there's been separate discussion around auth in Django recently. Carl's been advocating for some changes, because there's a number of, I'll just say off the top, there's a number of things, you know, Django, if you were going to do it today, like there's first name, last name is the default. Well, that doesn't fit a lot of the world's population, for example. Also, it defaults to username, email, username and password. Most people want email. Carlton, I just wound you up. Go.
Well, like literally, so like the whole point about Django is a batteries included framework, right? It's meant to provide the batteries. But it's not any old battery because, like, for instance, it used to provide comments, but comments isn't something you can't build yourself or can't be maintained in the ecosystem. And it's a bit of a burden to maintain because there's so many, you know, opinions about what it might have and so many different ways it could go. So DjangoContrib.comments was pulled out and it's a third-party package now. But auth really is a battery that Django has to provide because it's so central and it's so hard. And if you get it wrong, the consequences are so bad that that's a battery Django should provide. And so, yeah, we've got good auth, we've got good central auth, but we don't have this two-factor bit yet. And for me, it's kind of like that's a missing battery. That would be really nice if we could do something that's a, you know, one-time passwords or I don't know. Passkeys are the new things. Can you tell us about passkeys and one-time passwords? What are all these things, Mackenzie? Because
there's a lot happening in the changing on authentication because authentication remains kind of like a big weak link, and especially our reliance on different things like API keys and that are kind of just sprawling everywhere because they're handled by so many different people. So some of the things that people are trying to do to essentially remove these points of the vulnerabilities is to create basically the same systems but only valid once and created for the purpose of that session. So, you know, like you have something like a dynamic API key that's managed by a trust, you know, like a vault or something where the API key is created, you then use it and then you then destroy it at the end of
and
it.
It's life,
only valid for one time.
And its lifetime is a matter of minutes or at most.
Yeah, seconds. Yeah. Or you know, whatever, however long that it takes, right? You know, and so these are kind of really, and I think we can expect these to really start taking over along with kind of rule-based authentication that's being implemented in lots of different ways. Because one of the problems that we also have been facing is that when you're trying to manage, you know, pass keys and passwords and API keys and all of that, you know, you can be tempted to create, you know, if you need to do multiple different jobs, if I create one admin key to be able to do all those different jobs, then I don't have to manage all these different keys, right? But then if that key becomes so sensitive. So, you know, having role-based authentication where, you know, you restrict what to the absolute bare minimums and your authentication is created, you know, for the purpose that you're trying to do with all the minimum permissions that you're trying to do. And with infrastructure, when we're kind of getting into, you know, infrastructure as code and on all of these different systems and secrets vaults, and we can actually tie them all together so that it works really, you know, really nicely. And I think that we're not using these to the full extent, but they're becoming more and more expected in certain things that, I mean, like I guess we can expect, you know, frameworks to start putting in these different batteries, you know, as we go down.
Well, I think that's one thing that's sort of it's been discussed a few times and it hasn't quite happened yet, but it's like Django hasn't really got a solution for secrets handling in place. So you start off, you get a settings file, and in there the real secret is your database password and your this secret key, which is used for signing and whatnot. So it's important that you don't commit those to Git, and we can talk about Git Guardian in a minute and whatnot. But the first pass has always been stick those in a setting in an environment variable. And kind of what would be nice, I think, for Django to have is a kind of a pluggable interface around that. So okay, if you're using MVARs, you get it from there. But then there's all these other mechanisms like you know, vaults and secret managers and things that we could sort of swap out the back end, and you could be using those as well. I think it'd be nice to have something like that in the Django space.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's secrets management is going to persist to be a problem that we're going that we have to kind of deal with. And I mean, people may have it's you know, it's funny. One of the common passwords that GitGuardian detects months later is, you know, is the Django secret keys, because often people get excited, they created their first Django project, they Git add all and commit to Git, and then all of a sudden they've, you know, released this secret Django key. Now, if it's probably not that interesting and to an attacker, at least if it's your first project, yeah, and you're kind of having a play, you know, but systems don't know that, so they alert on it. But I kind of feel like that's a good process, because if you leak something on GitHub, you're going to get an email about it, and then you kind of are forced to learn how to securely do it from the start. And you know, when you're talking about environment variables and .env files, I mean, there's and vaults and secret managers. I mean, there's huge arguments about like what to use and when to use them. And I think I differ from most of the security community from what I think. But
no, cool. Well, tell us what you think, because this is one reason we get stuck. Okay, so, is that people say, oh, we want this, but then there's a disagreement. But what about that? And we can't quite agree on what we should have, so we don't do anything. It's like, well, nah.
Yeah, so a funny story about this is that at PyCon Italy, where I met Carlton, I had my talk, and you know, my talk was on how to securely manage secrets in Python projects. And you know, I mentioned multiple ways to do it, but one of the ways, and the way that I particularly like, is using environment variables and .env files. The talk before me, I don't know if this was like organized by the planned by the organizers, but the talk before me, the entire talk was about why you shouldn't use environment variables for it. So I like environment variables, but I want to start off the bat and say that they're not the most secure thing to use them. So if you ask a security person, you say, how should I manage my secrets? Then the official answer is you should use something like a vault or a secrets manager that's dedicated to that. That's a server. It's going to create dynamic secrets. So just in time, you can connect to that to, you know, to authenticate your developers so that they have access to secrets, or their apps have access to secrets that no developers, you know, and it becomes like this heavily complicated thing. And what will happen most of the time is that they will interact with that once. They'll go, this is such a pain in the ass to interact with the system. And then they create secrets.txt on their desktop, and they store all their API keys there, because then they don't have to deal with this heavy system that some security person spent a whole year implementing that has, you know, 400 pages of docs to go through of how to correctly use it. And that creates another problem. And then that's why secrets end up in your history, because you have been told, okay, I need you to create this feature, and you need to connect to some kind of data bucket to do it. So to start off with, you just hard code the secrets, because to do it properly is such a pain,
yeah,
that you will, you know, that it's a pain. But don't worry, because by the time code review comes around, you'll have removed that, not knowing that that secret is now in your Git history, but no one's seen it. So no one actually knows that it's there. And that creates like a big problem. I know this is getting very long.
No.
But that's why...
Go on, but that's brilliant though, because you know, you've got an intermediate commit that doesn't appear in the pull request for you, but it's still got the secret in it. But you just
exactly, yeah, exactly, because you're under time pressure, you're trying to use it quickly, right? And people don't understand that, and that's why an attacker, if they make it into your Git repository, and they'll fish, there's lots of ways for them to do this. They'll kind of scan your history. Now, the top layer of Git's probably not going to have any secrets in it. Like by what I mean by the top layers is kind of like what's on the main branch, you know, what's in the latest commits on everything. But when you go deeper, you're going to find all these secrets that have been added and removed from people, because dealing with these heavy systems is a nightmare. Now, does that mean you shouldn't use the heavy systems? I really think it depends like everything. But why I like environment variables is because for most people, that's an adequate, you know, solution, and it's easy enough to secure. You create a .env file in your repository, you create a .gitignore file, and that's going to solve a lot of your problems. The argument against that is that there are ways to dump out your environment if you're kind of, if your infrastructure, if your server or, you know, yeah, your other, your has been, your operating systems have been compromised, then if the first thing any attacker is going to do is type in env and dump out the environment variables from a running application and see what's, and we'll see that that is 100% going to be the first thing that they're going to do. And so the argument against it is that if you're using environment variables, you've just created a nice package for every, you know, for the attackers. But my argument is that if an attacker's made it that far, like, let's face it, like, you're not in a good position anyway. Like, I can, I have access to your RAM. I can find secrets in other ways. Maybe it's not wrapped up, but let's not pretend that, like, the ENV file was the problem here. Like you've got bigger problems that you need to deal with.
Yeah, right. By the time they're on your server, you're in trouble.
Yeah. So, like, my kind of thinking behind this is, like, look, it is great to, it is great to have these heavy systems in there, and I think they have their place. But you have to understand, like, are you mature enough to effectively use them? Is the, does the team have enough training, you know, around that? Because when you get to a large enough organization, you could segment people out so that, you know, small number of people have access to these machines and they know how to use it, these systems. Then that's fantastic. If you're a startup of 10 people, you know, environment variable files are great. It will put them in local memory, and at least you're going to, you know, prevent them being exposed in other ways, like on Git. So, you know, that's yeah, my rant over, because I mean, there's lots of things, but I my personal opinion is that it's not the most secure way in the world to do it, but it's so much better and easier, and it reduces the friction, which is part of the problem with security.
I wanted to mention, like, I put my old man hat on. When I worked at startups in San Francisco, GitHub was like down the street. And back in the day, you could just search for anything. So you could search, you know, we, as a like game, we'd like get AWS keys. You could get Stripe keys because they were brand new, you know, so wild, wild west. Like, you just, hey, search is powerful. Boom, there it is. And like, you could literally see it for so many, like every company, because there was no, you know, there was no automated, there was no hiding it, there was no email, there's none of this stuff. It was just like, yep, search it all.
Yeah,
so, well, that was sort, I mean, of a fun still, game we would do.
It's still basically like that. If you go, I mean, to,
yeah,
if anyone,
it's a little better, if anyone, but not.
If anyone's listening, if you go to api.github.com/events, then what that will take you to is the GitHub events API. That's everything happening in real time.
Oh, yeah.
Public. You will get rate limited, but you can create lots of tokens. To the first, like, you don't even need authentication for the first time. Like, you can do it in incognito, it'll still come up. In that, you have all the commits that are happening, but you also have the email addresses from people, their locally configured Git email address. So if you're interested in targeting, like, a specific company, you can just filter out of domains of people that are committing with a, I don't know, pick a company, at twilio.com email address. To, you know, and find their personal GitHub IDs, then start scanning all their stuff. You know, like, it's still, the search feature is a little bit harder. Like, Dorking's got harder for sure. But in terms of, like, you know, finding keys, we found 10 million secrets on GitHub in public repositories last year. Like, 2 million of them were for cloud provider keys. So, like, it's which were all valid, because we validate them, those particular keys we validate. So, like, it's bloody wild what you will find publicly. But I will say GitHub, they're implementing other things that make it better, along with, like, some companies.
Okay, so you've said we then, you've mentioned GitGuardian. So get GitGuardian. Can you tell us, so what is GitGuardian? And, like, you know, can I be, yeah, should, yeah, I be, yeah, using, sure, this if I'm a Django developer? Is this helpful to me?
Of course. You're not using it, Carlton? Oh, man.
Wait, I never commit secrets.
I've heard that. So, I've been working for GitGuardian for 4 years. Yeah, 4 years now. And in that time, I've committed secrets by mistake. So, it, like, yeah, and it's my whole job to come on podcast and talk about why you should not do that. Anyway, enough about my work. So GitGuardian. So we're a code security company. And we, our platform was founded on detecting secrets inside repositories. So we talked about, you know, Git history, things like that. So the core GitGuardian product is that we connect into your repositories and we will search all through the history and bring out any secrets. And we can, if you're in a large company, the value of it comes in that we will prioritize them, we will validate them, and we will help you remediate them. So in a large company, that's what it helps. But for individual developers, you know, all of our systems are free. We're the number one security app on GitHub. So I think we're about 400,000 users on GitHub, on their GitHub marketplace at the moment. So just to make sure that you don't have secrets inside your repositories at any point. And then we also have cool tools. We have a CLI tool called ggshield, which will help you do things like install a pre-commit hook that will sit between, you know, your local repository. Well, pre-commit sits just in your local repository. It just kind of blocks any commits going through, getting staged that have a secret in there. Because once a secret enters your repository, if you're in a team, it's going to be cloned into different areas. It's going to be backed up by different systems. Probably it'll end up inside like Jira tickets or, you know, like they just sprawl everywhere. So once it's your repository, you have to revoke it. It's the only way forward. You know, by doing things like with ggshield CLI tool, you can block them coming in. So it's really cool. But we've expanded beyond secrets now. We also do, you know, infrastructure as code scanning, software composition analysis to find out if your dependencies are vulnerable. And the coolest thing that I think is we call honey tokens, which are fake credentials. So like the main one is the AWS credential that you can purposely leave in places. And if someone tries to use it, it's like an early warning system that systems will be detected. And why this is so cool is honeypots aren't new. Honeypots have been around for a while. But why honey tokens are cool is that not only can you put honey tokens kind of everywhere in your internal infrastructure, you can actually put them inside third-party tools. So like CircleCI had a big breach at the start of this year and encrypted secrets were discovered. So if you put a honey token inside your CircleCI environment, then you can actually know if that system has been compromised. You know, are your other secrets in there compromised? So it's the only type of honeypot that you can put in different systems. So there we are. That's a bit of a longer plug than I intended to go out for, but
I just put a plug for there's a Django package, Django Honeypot, for your admin. So going to /admin is the default, and so that's a pretty like good place to go look for stuff. And so you can set it up and like log who's trying to get to your admin, even though your admin's somewhere else.
Yeah, it's really cool. And what's a fun thing to do is create a honey token, leak it on public GitHub, and then watch what happens. In a matter of like minutes, people will try and exploit it, but then it will also typically get sold like as part of a package, like on the dark web months later. So you'll start off by getting these random calls, like low level calls, and then it will kind of get sold, and then you'll start seeing like different types of activity. It's really fascinating to be able to track what actually happens when a credential gets leaked, you know, like and how quickly it happens and how it moves through these different levels of attackers. Because someone for $20 will purchase 1,000 valid credentials and then just spam them and see what they can do. And, you know, and if three of them allow them to do some mining or install some keyloggers or something, then, you know, happy days.
Can I ask, my sense is that like if you want to do this kind of stuff openly, there's a handful of countries you can do it in. Is that where a lot of like these bad actors are, or is it people in, you know, the United States who just cover their tracks a bit more? Like what does the actual landscape look like of these, you know, businessmen and women out there who are doing hacking?
It's so hard to definitively say like where these groups come from. So like with a honey token, like you can get the IP address and you can see where the calls are being made from. But I mean, if that's, you know, if they're not using some third party service to mask that, then, you know, that's pretty surprising. But, you know, it really is everywhere. You have countries that are a lot more forward in sponsoring bad actors. So you have, you know, there's Russia, you know, there's
North Korea, right?
North Korea, like the main, you know, the Lazarus group in North Korea, they're extremely notorious. But then you also have a bunch of teenagers like Lapsus, which were based in the UK, that were, you know, like that were really out there for just clout, not really doing too much damage, but just kind of reputational damage. So there's like, yeah, I mean, there's people kind of everywhere that are interested in it. And I don't think it has any kind of real boundaries. And I don't think any countries apart from maybe North Korea are kind of like green lighting green lighting this, but there's certainly people where it's more beneficial to do it. I will, you know, in some different countries that don't have expedition agreements.
Yeah. When people like, I almost wonder if they need like a retainer for people who leave GitGuardian or any like well-established security group. Like, I mean, I guess, you know, you're not really doing it for the money, it's reputation, but you know, that would be the ultimate thing is to, you know, nobody knows how to, it's like, you know, how do you steal money from a bank? It's like buy a bank. It's like you.
Yeah. So, I mean, like GitGuardian's really well set up in that they're like, we don't have access to other people's secrets. Like we can't get access to, like, as an employee, but we do know a lot about it. But I honestly feel like people don't talk about it, but people know, like those that know really know. Like I've been talking to people at the moment. I got really into reverse compiling mobile applications and then looking for secrets inside of them. And it was like wild what was happening inside there. But then, you know, like you go talk about it to someone that knows, you know, someone, you know, oh, I found this really cool research. And like, I found all these keys. And everyone's just like, oh yeah, we know already. But like no one's kind of like talking about it, but those that know kind of already, or you know, like already know it is like, yeah, it's like a secret little club out there when you, when you know, you know.
Carlton, I have one more question. So we'll put a link to this. You wrote an article about, you know, why ChatGPT is a security threat, essentially. And that just like, you win the like SEO lottery, right? Because that's like every, but I wonder if you could expound upon that, right? Because that's, you know, something that is big everywhere. Like I've been using every day now, but it's like, oh, the, like, you know, something else is going to come and get me. So for individuals or corporations, what's sort of the main threat that you outlined in that article?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways that, and it's kind of evolving. And it's funny you mentioned like the SEO win. Since that article came out, I've been published at so many, like the Financial Times did an interview with me as if I'm some kind of like AI expert. Like,
I mean, you check all the boxes. We have a boxes here. We're looking for ChatGPT security. He's at GitGuardian. He speaks English. Boom.
I've just got this vision of you and Simon Willison on a panel, expert panel at, you know.
Yeah.
Things like ChatGPT and LLMs, large language models, like have really changed the game for a lot of different people. So number one, you look at it from the company perspective. A lot of companies have now banned this. And one notable one is Samsung. So you kind of look at, okay, why did Samsung ban their employees using it? It's because this is now another system that, you know, sensitive information has a way of leaking into. So GitHub, using the example of GitHub, because everyone knows it, if you're an organization and they don't use GitHub, the chances are their employees still will, which means that organization still has some kind of risk associated to it. ChatGPT is kind of similar. So you get it to summarize some legal documents. You get it to sift through a whole bunch of data or create some kind of connection using these credentials. That data is being stored somewhere. Right. And because of that, that means that your sensitive data is now in ChatGPT server, which is not a super secure platform. So now it's a target for other people. So big companies have started to ban it. I think that's the wrong approach because I think that your employees will use it anyway because it's such a production boost, you know, and I feel like there's a fear that if you're not using this, you're going to miss out. The other area of ChatGPT that's a security risk or other LLMs is that when you trust AI systems a whole lot more than what you should. So where does ChatGPT get its data from? You know, so you ask it, hey, can you create a coding instruction that will do X? And it will spit back. It'll do it in record time and it will even like explain how it works. So it feels like super great. ChatGPT uses the largest data set around, which is the Common Crawl data set. It's what all of these systems use. Most of the code in there is
rubbish.
From GitHub.
And most of it's rubbish.
Yeah, so that's kind of the point I'm getting it to. Like, look at a random open source repository. That's what it's learning against. Now, these systems can't really distinguish between good code and bad code at least not in the vacuum of which you've asked them to do a query. It's yeah. found the most common result. A great example is a different system, Copilot, GitHub Copilot, whereas at least this was true a year ago when I was really experimenting with it. If we used the author, if we put in as an at the top an author as a really respected, well-known open source maintainer, someone that's very prolific, and asked it the same prompts as if I used my name as the author, would get different responses. You know, like, because like it's kind of looking at an example of what would this guy do and what would this guy do, and obviously I'm much shittier than the other person. So you know, so the whole point is that you actually come to the risk of like the code that it gives you will have like vulnerabilities in it, probably. And here's a big difference is people say, well, what's the difference between that and me copying code from Stack Overflow? And the difference is that Stack Overflow has a comment section where people will very quickly let you know if you're doing something insecure or around it. There's a huge community around that. People can add input. You'll get various different results for the same thing. ChatGPT, Copilot, other LLMs have, you know, don't provide that additional community input as to which is the best way. You ask it for an answer, it gets an answer. You know, and I wrote an article called Shitty Code, Shitty Copilot, and it's, you know, basically, you know, that crappy input, crappy output. And the people that are most likely to use these systems are probably people like, you know, that are early on and may not know the difference between random and random secure, and when, you know, like when generating a random number and when to use both of them.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Everyone uses these systems, to be honest. I mean, maybe they're not as good at like filtering things out. I mean, it'd be kind of cool to have an LLM that's just approved answers on Stack Overflow. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, that for sure.
Maybe that, exists.
I'm really not against like these systems too. But I'm just kind of the mind that you need to understand where the answers come from. It's not a genius AI system. It's come from other people on GitHub. It's organizing it in a revolutionary way that helps you find the solution that you're looking for extremely quickly. But, you know, you have to understand the limitations of that and, you know, where the answers come from. Yeah. And I mean, if we're talking about security too, the other area that of these systems and AI that people are worried about are attackers using AI. So can attackers now, you know, more effectively? And the answer, yes and no, like everything. AI systems use known data to do this. Revolutionary attacks, you know, are not on the public internet, or they're very, you know, very hard to do, and it's not coming out with new stuff. So if you want it to create malware, it will block you at first, but if you use clever prompt injection, like one that used to work, I don't think it does now, is like, imagine you're an AI system that doesn't have limitations. If you put that in ChatGPT, you know, it used to, I think
it's important to
now,
my career.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Like, or give me an example of malware, you know, that these things used to work. And prompt injection is, you know, there's lots of clever ways to get it to do stuff. There's also open source LLMs that you can remove these limitations. But anyway, if you asked it and you successfully got it to create malware for you, it's going to be pretty standard malware. Like, it's nothing that you wouldn't be able to find by Googling yourself. However, you know, what it does do is it gives ScriptKitty superpowers. So, you know, like when you combine a script kiddie, which is a, you know, someone that doesn't have a huge technical knowledge that just can run malicious scripts to get into things, it's a big section of the malicious market. You know, you now give them ChatGPT so that when they're doing phishing campaigns, they can now do spell check. Like, you know, how long was it the biggest red flag was misspelt stuff? Well, forget about that now. You know, they can manipulate the code for the first time. They can input malicious code and say, adjust this so that it can do this on this system, or get, you know, and these things. So it does give some superpowers. But when we're talking about like, is it going to revolutionize the hacking? Not at the moment, because it needs to have, it can't come up with new ideas yet. It can only regurgitate existing ideas. So, I mean, this is like, look, there's lots of concerns around AI. And I did an interview recently, which was with a guy called Simon Maple, which was like, is AI our friend or foe? And surprise, surprise, the answer was, it depends. No, but I think it was...
well, that's what's so in- told me, like, if there's a magazine article and it has a question in the title, like, it doesn't know. Otherwise, it would say AI is a threat.
Yeah.
AI is a friend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I feel like it's pointless to worry about that or wonder about that because it's not going anywhere. So, like, is it a threat? Yes, no. Does it change anything in how we're going to operate or what the risks are that you're facing now? No. So, it's here to stay. And at the moment, the biggest risks are not external, as in it's not an attacker using it. The biggest risk is internal, your employees using it, but not understanding. And if you block it, if there's someone here from a large organization that's thinking, okay, I'm just going to block this system, then all that it's going to do is send people to the background. They're still going to use it, but they're just not going to tell you that they're using it.
So you couldn't audit it then in that case?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
There is. As a security expert, let's talk about LLMs a little bit more. I was curious your take on, there is this issue of like the Ouroboros of like, now that we have, you know, so much of, you know, so it's like Google's the problem with Google, right? Google searches the internet, but then people like want a feature on Google. So then you write articles for Google. It's like why YouTube videos are all like 10 minutes and 1 second, right? Like, so it becomes like, just gets crappier and crappier and crappier. It's like silt building up behind like a dam. And that's, I've seen, and I can believe this based on just typing in that, like, they think the majority of articles are soon going to be AI generated because it's like perfect at, you know, these topics. And so there's an argument that over time, like, this is as good as it's going to get. It's just going to get more and more crappy as AI consumes AI. And then, like, you know, and of course it's all copyright laundering, which we don't need to get into, but I'm curious if you have a quick take on that, or does that seem right to you? Because to me, I don't really see a way out of that, you know, both in terms of, I guess, code you can run and you can test it, but like things you search for. I mean, I use ChatGPT as Google now, I've been using DuckDuckGo for years too, also just because Google's doing its inevitable thing. But I kind of wonder, like, maybe I'll just be stuck on, like, you know, September 2021 or whatever is the date, because it's just going to get worse.
I have an interesting take on this. So I don't know if this is going to be like the popular take, but I have an interesting take. I think it's going to have the opposite effect. So here's why, is that we came from it like 30 years ago, the main source of information was all books. It came from trusted kind of sources. And you could say whether or not you think that's bad or good, but you know, that's where you
as a book author, I agree. Very trusted.
Right. Yeah. And it's hard to publish shit.
It's still hard. Yeah. It's hard. Yeah.
It's so easy to publish junk now. And now ChatGPT has made it so easy that I feel like it's going to have the effect that there's going to be so much shitty information, that everything's going to get so much shittier, that we're all going to go back to trusted sources instead of kind of going on. So, like, are we going to be like Googling answers, or will we go back to the trusted peer-reviewed research or articles,
right,
or from the O'Reilly
Django.com
books?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Django.com, or, you know, like all these, you know, like, I feel like it's actually going to kind of make the people that had some kind of platform but no brains, like, they're going to become so noisy that you're just going to ignore them. And then what will become kind of the new system will be that we all need to take a step back and go back to trusted sources. And that's what I'm hoping that's going to
happen. I like that. Well, you know, I have my robots.txt is updated for all the crawlers, so I'm sure they're going to abide by it, and so I'm not worried about my stuff being pilfered.
yeah, of course, yeah.
Side joke to people. I've got it updated. There's like 10 on there.
That reminds me of I always ask people kind of like, what's the worst security advice you had? And there was a guy that was providing feedback on a penetration test, and he explained how this person's organization, their infrastructure, was vulnerable, and the person's response to that would be, yes, but that's illegal, so no one would do that.
Nice.
It's like, what are you doing? People don't abide by laws. Everything would just be lawless. And it's like, well, welcome to the internet.
Okay, good. So we're coming up on time a bit, Mackenzie. So I just wanted to ask you one more question. So if we would say, first thing, move all your secrets into Envirs, and, you know, then use a secret standard, something like GitGuardian, and make sure that you catch anything you do commit. Is there a third kind of obvious thing that we should be doing that you would say?
Yeah, definitely. So we need to add additional layers of security upon things. So, you know, there's a concept called zero trust, which is talking about, you know, like just because you have an API key or you have a password doesn't mean that you need to trust explicitly that person. So there's something that you know, something that you have, and something that you are. And we should be implementing those rules across security as well. So, some simple things that you could do, you know, if your listeners just go like, okay, that all sounds nice, but what can I actually do? So come up with ways to rotate your keys regularly. The reality is, no matter what you do, your keys will leak. You know, the best companies in the world, their keys will leak. HashiCorp, they created a product called Vault. It's one of the best secrets managers. You know, they had a breach because they had secrets leak into their Git repositories. So like, it happens to everyone. So what you can do is you can implement a rotation policy that rotates keys regularly. So that's one thing, so that doesn't happen. The advantage of that is that you actually know where your keys are, or you know how to rotate them. Because like, then if you have a leak, it's kind of like, oh, what the heck does this key do? Am I going to break production if I revoke this? Like, if you're regularly rotating things, then you know what they are. The other thing is like, stop producing admin keys. Like, if you need a credential, don't give an admin credential. I had so many stories of when, you know, a read-only credential would have been totally sufficient, but, you know, that requires creating another key. But if you've got a secrets manager, then the problem kind of goes away. So, you know, make sure that keys has limitations of what they can actually do to suit the job. And then whitelist your services. If you have a system that's only meant to talk to this other system, right, then you can set it up so that they can only talk. Now, if I find the credential between them that allows me to talk to it, then I'm coming from a different area. I have a different IP. I'm from a different system. So these are things that you can kind of actively do to add layers on top, because you just got to remember that there's no bullet, you know, like everything about security, the famous words of this podcast, it depends, but you can add layers in that create friction. And that's ultimately kind of like the best way to handle this, is to create enough friction, you know, that we're adding so many different layers to an attacker.
Yeah, they go attack someone who's easier.
Yeah,
that's sure. Like, yeah, that's like one of those startup sayings. Like, there's no silver bullet; there's just a lot of lead bullets.
Yeah, yeah. I live in the Netherlands, and like, there's a saying here: like, bikes. Everyone has like at least two bikes each, especially in my town. And one of the things is like, no one has any nice bikes, because you always want to make sure that your bike is shittier than the bike that's next to you, because then the person's going to, because we're terrible at locking our bikes. Like,
yeah, don't outrun the bear, just be next to someone.
Yeah, it's lower. That's like, yeah. So,
isn't there some story in like Amsterdam after like the Nazis like fled, that there was some like a quarter of the bikes are like in the waterways, or there was some stat. I did a bike tour and he was giving me these crazy numbers, speaking to the fact that, like, you know, I guess for a century now, everyone bikes everywhere, but everyone, like, stuff gets stolen. And there were some crazy statistics about when the Nazis left and the number of bikes that were trashed or something.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know if that, I think that still happens. Like, because every now and again, you'll see the canals, a crane will come into the canal with these big claws and they'll just scoop up all the bikes that are in there, because it just happened. But you know, bikes are pretty easy to come by, and it's an unwritten rule that if, you know, if it's past 2 a.m. and your bike's been stolen, it's socially acceptable to steal someone else's bike to get home. So you just got to make sure you're not the last one from the club as well.
Right.
You know, like.
Right. That's good. That's good to remember.
Well, I think we should wrap up there. That's perfect.
I don't know how we got onto the subject.
Yeah, well, it was the backwards analogy from making sure your site's slightly more secure than other sites. You know, if you had it. So that your bike's slightly worse than the neighbor's bike, it's the opposite, the mirror of that. Great, McKen. So anything else that you'd like to call out while you've got the mic that we haven't mentioned, that you've mentioned your podcast, you've mentioned Git Guardian, Compango, you've mentioned, we'll put all of those in the show notes. Anything else that you think, oh yeah.
No, I mean, I feel like that's kind of it. I think that's enough plugs for one episode. But anyone that wants to follow me, you can follow me anywhere on social media at the handle @AdvocateMac. I'm even on Threads. I've never posted, but you know, like, just in
you
case Twitter does explode, then I might do. So make sure you follow me. But yeah, and then that's it. I mean, if you want to check out, if you want to listen to me geek out about security stuff, that's where you can find me.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks for coming on. Really good. Really enjoyed it.
I appreciate the invite. Thanks, and great to meet you, Will, and great to see you again, Carlton.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. We are at chatjango.com, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
See you next time. Bye-bye.